Mr. Manhattan doesn't have any questions. I'll look on next.
Mr. Pinnell? Okay. Well, then, block your report.
You will.
You'll follow on after, though.
All right. Thank you.
So we'll let you remove it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Hello. Good morning, rather, again. So I just want to ask you, primarily, you'll be aware that my client's concerned primarily around stock exclusion and setbacks and a few more, so not going into the DO issues, etc. Did you, as part of, you're involved in the first hearing of PC1?
I was.
As part of that, or as part of this process, did you go to any of the Hill Country farms and have a look on site at the stream?
I haven't been on the sites of the particular farmers who've given evidence, but I have been to some of those sites, in particular the Orpunotea River and driven through the upper Waipa catchment, maybe for a look around there.
So through past Te Kuiti?
No, closer.
Okay.
On the other side.
I want to, if we can start then with ephemeral streams. So your proposal is that ephemeral streams be permanently fenced. Is that correct?
I don't know that it's necessary to permanently fence them. And I think that's really part of the package you would look at in terms of critical source area management. It may be that temporarily fencing or other methods of fencing, which I don't understand because I'm not a farm systems expert, might be adequate to ensure contaminants aren't moving in those drainage systems, particularly under times of heavy rainfall.
But you'll be aware that the farmers can't run out and put fences up every time it starts to rain and then bring them back in again. So if there was a requirement to fence ephemeral streams, it would need to be permanent, wouldn't it?
Not all rainfall events will cause ephemeral streams to flow, and that's really determined by the incoming weather.
Right, but is it your proposal? I'm just trying to be clear on what the farmers have to do. So is it your proposal that in some rain events they'll need to fence ephemeral streams?
Yes, particularly in heavy rain that's incoming. And that's usually some weather forecast basis, I understand.
Are you aware of what the length of ephemeral streams is on some properties?
The ephemeral stream network is extensive.
So on Mr. Cameron's property, there might be 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 metres of ephemeral streams.
I don't know on a property basis, but I understand in the catchment the extent is considerable. The difficulty in estimating that accurately is understanding where the boundary of an ephemeral stream is.
And so the proposal would be that on each farm, the farmer goes out and fences an ephemeral stream in advance of certain heavy weather, up to several thousand metres of fencing.
If that's what's necessary to avoid the transfer of contaminants into the drainage network, the research which suggests that 77% of the contaminant load comes in through those networks, yes, it might be hard and impractical, and I can't speak to that because I'm not a farm systems expert, but I understand that to be the evidence. But if I coin a phrase, the inconvenient truth is if we want to reduce contaminants by the degree that's necessary in order to reach some of the targets, then we will have to target those areas for management.
Yeah, and I want to come back to some of those before, but you agree, I think, you agree you have no farm systems expertise,
yes.
No farming expertise, no fencing expertise, And you accept it might be impracticable to temporarily fence ephemeral streams.
I only have anecdotal experience from my own property.
Okay. In terms of the assessment that you've done, you've assumed that the REC 1 streams are ephemeral, REC 2 intermittent, and REC 3 permanent?
It's a very big assumption, and it is a limitation on the GIS analysis that was done, and we've acknowledged that. The real difficulty is that many of those networks are not mapped or known. I think the joint witness statement, we really desired there to be some form of mapping and identification at a larger scale.
Yeah, and my understanding is that the REC 1 would grossly underestimate the actual length of ephemeral streams on a property. Would you agree with that?
I can't speak to how much it would underestimate them without some actual on-ground truth of what that might look like.
But it will be an underestimate, not an overestimate.
Yes.
So the cost of fencing, etc., would be more than what's been assumed.
I can't speak to the cost.
Well, if the length is more than my friend took you through a number of the critical source area provisions in the farm environment plan, so I don't think I need to take you back through those. But my understanding from your answers to my friend were that you agree that critical source areas are essential to manage?
Yes.
And do you agree that farmers in an on-farm site assessment undertaken at the right weather conditions would be able to easily identify where those critical source areas are?
Yes, I think it's preferable to ground truth them under the conditions that I explained earlier.
And in fact, you can only do them on the farm, can't you?
Yes, although the council has undertaken some LiDAR analysis which might give us more precision than the REC currently does.
Yeah, but as things stand, in terms of understanding critical source areas, you've got to go on farm and have a look, don't you?
I think to understand the management techniques which might be available within the envelope that we've got, then that would be preferable to ground truth on farm basis.
Yeah. And that's do you see that as being a strength of the farm environment plan process, having a certified farm planner and the farmer walking around identifying critical source areas, identifying areas where you can get the best bang for buck in terms of water quality improvements?
Theoretically, yes, but I haven't seen a farm plan. I haven't read farm plans that address that in a specific manner and been able to go out and ground truth the reality of the stream network with what's addressed in the farm plan.
When you're driving through some of the hill country farms in the Upper Waipa, would you agree with me that just about every gully would end up being an ephemeral stream?
Many. I did go through under some heavy rainfall conditions which were quite unpleasant. And definitely, I would say roughly half the gully systems that I saw on my very anecdotal field site were flowing and under heavy rain.
I want to turn then to stock exclusion. Just before I do that, I think you mentioned at the start in oral evidence that you referred to the Northland Regional Plan.
Yes.
Were you involved in that process?
Not at the stock exclusion. That was just with reference to setbacks and cultivation or land preparation, I think it's called in that plan.
Were you aware that in that plan it's a permitted activity for stock to enter ephemeral and intermittent streams?
I am peripherally aware of that.
So the only stock exclusion in the Northland Regional Plan is from permanently flowing streams?
I will take your word for that. I haven't read the provisions relating to stock exclusion.
And there's no setback requirements? You also mentioned, I think, the Southland Regional Plan in the context of stock exclusion, though.
I think I spoke to setbacks. There is some exclusion from critical source areas dependent on what farm activity is being undertaken at the time.
But dry stock farms generally in the Southern Regional Plan are not required to exclude stock from waterways, would you not?
I don't know.
Okay. You'll be familiar with the stock exclusion regulations?
I am.
And you're aware that there's an amendment which tomorrow, maybe today, the 5th, I think.
Apparently so, yes.
Yeah, and I think we talked about that. And you're aware that my clients obviously are not challenging the requirements of the stock exclusion regulations, so they will be required to comply with those.
I understand that's
yep.
the case.
And the plan change one provisions, they apply on top of those requirements in the stock exclusion regulations.
Yes, but I believe the regulation allows plans to be more stringent.
Yep, so some of the differences are the require the exclusion of stock from permanent streams of lever size, the stock exclusion regs are wide rivers, so 1 metre. And from all intermittent streams of whatever size up to 10 degrees. And the PC1 provisions is my clients are seeking. And all forms of intensive grazing must be excluded from water bodies. Are you aware of the definition? It's actually intensively grazing in the stock exclusion regulations. Are you aware of?
I did remind myself of that last night, but I can't remember
what it is. Which will help me. So again, my clients accept that any intensively grazing activities, it's an odd choice of phrase, but that's what we're working with. That has to be fenced. Stock has to be excluded from intensively grazing activities. So those intensively grazing activities include fencing behind a wire, break feeding, grazing on annual forage crops, and grazing on pasture that's been irrigated with water in the previous 12 months.
Yes.
From a water quality perspective, do you agree that those are the higher risk, if not the highest risk, normal pastoral farming activities that can be undertaken?
Definitely, for things like break feeding, anywhere where the bare ground is exposed is of high risk for contaminant transport into the stream.
And PC1 requires those areas to be stock to be excluded from the, if those activities are going on in the paddock.
Can you point me to the
provision?
Schedule C. It's like a reminder.
You've probably got the unnumbered page number there. But it's
I've got a page number on this one.
Oh, good. So it's Schedule C1B, Roman 1. It should, I think, actually, a note for Mr. Trebilka, I think that's intensively grazing. Intensive grazing.
Yes. My recollection of the regulation, though, isn't that it requires general streams to be fenced.
No, that's true. This is just what PC1 requires. So it refers to that definition, and it requires up to 10 degrees to be fenced, and then over 10 degrees to be fenced if you're doing intensive grazing.
Yes.
So that would cover those high-risk activities you're talking about already, right?
With the exclusion of the headwater network.
The ephemeral, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, and we'll come back to those, but so you agree with me that a combination of those measures that we've just talked about will generate significant water quality improvements on farms in the PC1 catchment?
I think it will generate some, but as I said, the issue is really with the contaminant load that comes out of that ephemeral network has been disproportionately higher than for other water bodies. So it's difficult to understand the exact degree to which that might occur, noting that the paper that identified the 77% did look to try and look at excluded water bodies versus included water bodies for fencing.
Yeah.
And they might not be exactly aligned with the regulations as they now sit, but I understand they're pretty close.
And you understand that from reading McDowell paper?
Yes.
Okay, well, let's go to that because I asked some questions, and we may have a difference of opinion on this, but I just want to put to you what my interpretation, what my witness's interpretation of the McDowell paper is.
I don't have a paper copy.
it's a general question, but yeah, I'll let you get
the paper from it.
Yeah, no, that's fine. It was cited in your evidence, I think.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm going to do it electronically. Tab 23, yeah, that sounds right, I think.
I think there's no electronic only or the secondary.
Oh, no, it's 2017. Oh, no, maybe. No, that's the air wallows. These are 2017. I thought it was 57. 53. 53. Yeah, tab 53, I think, was the one. One is available.
Sorry, I don't have a tab 53.
Do we have a half of the secondary sources?
No. I'll have to provide it electronic only.
Yeah.
Okay.
No,
that's secondary sources and events, there are those numbers and the stuff that's here.
Yeah.
That never got printed, did it?
No.
Okay. Can I just try asking the question? And if you need to go to the paper, we can go to the paper. Otherwise, you know, I might see something to get a hard copy printed.
Well, I've got a copy here.
Sure.
Yep. Thank you, sir. That's appreciated. So, and I gather this is based on paragraph 62 of the evidence in chief. I support the inclusion of small streams in Schedule C as the technical evidence shows that proportionately small streams are the greatest contributors of contaminants in low-land catchment areas. Is that?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I don't want to go into the technical detail, but I just want to ask an overall question in fairness to you, because I think my client's experts have a different perspective. Do you agree that conclusion, that it's the greatest source of contaminants,
yes,
is because of the area of land that those small streams cover, rather than the intensity of the contaminant loss from the land adjacent to those small streams? In other words, on a per hectare basis, more contamination is generated on flatter land with higher water streams than on steeper land with lower water streams.
Hmm. That's an interesting question. I think I've got a couple of things that I would say about that, and one would be about the intensity. I think there's a real difficulty with understanding the area versus intensity relationship, and that's because the intensity occurs on a mosaic across those networks. So I do know that headwater streams are break fed across. I have seen that in a number of catchments, and that would be an intensity that would provide a disproportionate flow of contaminants into the stream network that's more of an effect than the area nature of that network. What was the second point that you asked me? Sorry?
No, it was just on a per hectare. I mean, and this is quite an important issue, because I read the McDowell paper to say that 51% of the area of the catchment they analysed was of stream water 1. And that's on the top of the page. And that's not surprising, is it? You'd expect the lower water streams to cover the greatest area, wouldn't you?
Sorry, the top of the page.
Oh, sorry, I'll just get the reference to it. It is implications for management, so it's on page 1045. Nationally, the proportion of catchment in stream waters 1 to 8 decreases in the following sequence: 51, 23, 13, 7, 3, 2, 1, and less than 1%. I read that sentence as saying 51% of the catchment is stream water 1.
that it is speaking to area there. It's not immediately apparent on the face of it.
Okay, can I ask you to go to page 1044, the previous page, and in the middle sentence, middle paragraph, it starts off for all other contaminants. And then after Woody's Ale 2005, it says, in theory, runoff derived contaminant yields should be greater in smaller streams with a greater proportion of flow or surface runoff than larger streams. However, this does not take into account likely interactions, etc., etc. And it goes on in that paragraph to say, losses of most contaminants increase with land use intensity, and specifically with the proportion of catchment and pastoral.
Yeah, the proportion of catchment and pastoral land use is the relationship of how much pastoral land is in the catchment to the contaminant loss. It's not in relation necessarily to the area stream proportion. What we know is that catchments that have a greater proportion of pastoral land use in them give off more contaminants, and I think that's what this paper is alluding to in that sentence.
I think, and look, I probably don't need to take it any further, and I just wanted to put it to you that in a lower order, sorry, in a higher order stream on flatter land, we get land use intensity of 200, 300, 400, 500, 600 stock units a hectare. That is going to generate more contaminants per hectare than in the hill country, where it's 6 to 9 stock units per hectare. Do you agree with that from a water quality perspective?
I can't speak to the stock units per hectare, but the issue here is there's a bit of a mismatch between what stream water means and the amount of catchment contributing. So we have stream water 8 catchment, that's essentially the entire catchment is contributing to that.
Yeah, well, I understood the McDowell paper, and I read it quite carefully, addressed that by individually separating out each catchment under each segment of analysis it did. And so, otherwise, you're right, the bottom of the catchment would always have the most. And I understood they had to deal with that in their methodology by separating out each segment. I don't need you to go to it, but is that not your understanding?
No, that's not my understanding.
Okay. But, and if that's the case, then obviously the contaminant load should increase as you go downstream.
Yes.
Okay.
Load, yeah. Concentration, not necessary.
Yep. Okay. Well, look, in fairness, I wanted to put that to you because my experts have a different view on that paper, so that's helpful. Thank you. Right, can we go back to So in terms of the setback we've talked about, I think you're saying 10 metres each side of a permanent stream, correct?
Yes.
And that would apply even if the permanent stream is 20 centimetres wide?
Yes. The issue there is streams in the pasture become narrowed due to sediment deposition over time. So even a narrow stream can have quite a high concentration of contaminants.
So in Mr. Berry's property, and I hate keeping on coming back to him, but in his property he has spring-fed stream water 1 streams out of the side of a hill that are in the tens of centimetres wide, no upstream catchment to speak of, and you would require a 10-metre setback.
Well, that would be a first-order stream coming out of the spring.
So, but you would still require a 10-metre setback? Across all of the springs on all of his property, on all of the hillsides where these are coming from.
It does refer specifically to springs and provisions.
Well, sorry, I'm just talking about permanent stream. So the permanent stream in that case is fed by a spring, but there's no distinction, is there, in your provision between permanent streams fed by springs and other streams, is it?
No, it's whether they're permanently flowing or not.
Yep. Okay. Now, I just want to talk about WIP. Can I ask you to go to the joint witness diagram, and that's tab 401.0024, so it's tab 1 of, you might have it in front of you, it's tab 1 of volume 401.
001.
00001 00024.
Yep,
4 hour.
Sorry, what's the question number?
Oh, now he's got me.
He's very familiar with this.
Yes, I thought you would. Okay. So this is a diagram that has sediment removal, and I'm just talking about sediment, not other contaminants here. So talking about sediment removal efficiency on top, setback width on the bottom. And that's in metres, correct?
Yes.
So the dots on the paper, on the line, are they at, well, are they at 1, 3, 5, and 10 and 20 metres?
Yes, they are.
Yeah. The Sweeney paper you referred to, I read that paper. So that's about forested buffers in the United States.
Yes, we did discuss it. It was a bit of an outlier compared to the other research that we looked at.
Okay. So if we put that to one side for now and look at the other three.
Yes.
So even with a 1 metre setback, from sediment removal efficiency, you'll get something in the order of a benefit of 30 to 70%, 65-70%.
It depends on the study. Some of those studies aren't measuring, like the Zhang paper, and that takes into account a very wide number of studies and aggregates the data. Some of those studies are a lesser review or individual studies, so with one set of experimental design. I think the Zhang paper is probably the more reliable due to the number of studies that it incorporates into those conclusions.
Yeah, so even the Zhang paper, you're looking at a benefit of a 1 metre setback for sediment removal of something like 35%.
That's because the model has to fit 0 to 0 in the conditions they use, so it requires an exponential curve, which has to start somewhere, yes.
Right. But, I mean, I think...
Yes, it does start at roughly 35%.
Yeah, and I think, and so a 3 metre setback would be, somewhere in the order of 50%?
I think it looks like the 3 is about 65%.
Right. And then, so from a sediment, in terms of sediment removal efficiency, and looking at a length of 100 metres, there'd be no discernible difference in sediment removal efficiency, would there? If there'd be some areas that are at 2.2 metres and other areas at 3.3, 3.5 metres. Mm-hmm. There'd be no meaningful difference in sediment removal efficiency over that full length, would there?
Potentially, because the findings in that paper were that the first 5 metres of a buffer does the main load of work in terms of particular contaminant removal. So there might well be some differences. The buffer width is related to the efficiency. So trying to average it out over a reach, I'm not sure that the data supports the ability to differentiate that.
Okay, but at a basic level, some setback's better than none?
Oh, always some setback is better than none.
Yeah, and at a 2.5 metre setback, you'll still get good sediment removal.
You will still get some sediment removal. Good is relative to the receiving environment and what you're trying to do.
Yeah. And then if you look at that paper, it becomes a swiftly, sort of after 5 metres, there becomes a law of diminishing returns quite significantly, doesn't it, in terms of setback?
It's because it's subject to an exponential model.
Yeah. I just want to ask you one other question about that paper, and I gave you your counsel a copy of this last night, so hopefully it helped you sleep. I'm finished with that other paper in case Hazana doesn't want you to walk off.
Thank you. They're a terrible lot.
So if we go to page 80, stuff. So those are the four diagrams, and I'm assuming that's where you got the, that's where you sourced your input for your multiple paper. Is that? So the JWS grab, I'm sorry, I should have asked this. Did you do that grab?
No, that's from Fenimore and Summer Racine.
Okay, right, okay. Sorry, I thought you might have put it together. But in any event, on the left-hand side, so that's the removal efficiency, buffer width, it looks pretty similar. And then there's pesticide contaminants, so sediment and pesticides. We just go over the page. I want to ask you about figure four. And I'll ask you this because obviously slope's quite an issue in this proceeding in terms of access, in terms of at what slope should stock exclusion occur. So this is sediment removal efficiency and then slope percentage across the bottom. And you'll see the sediment removal efficiency goes up as the slope increases generally, and then about 10% it starts decreasing again.
Unfortunately, the slope here is referring to the slope of the buffer.
Yeah, referring
to the slope of the contributing land.
Yeah, you know, I understand that. But in terms of a lot of these catchments that we're talking about, the buffer and the land continues in one line. So if we can just focus on this. So I understand that the as a percentage, so 10% is 5.7 degrees. Is that right? 5 degrees is 8.75%.
Oh, you mean slope versus?
Yeah, so degree. It took me a while to sort this out in my head, but so degrees versus percent. So 5 degrees, 8.75%, 10%, 5.7 degrees, and 10 degrees, 17.7%. So on that basis, then, as far as sediment removal efficiency goes, and in terms of slope of the buffer area, is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah.
So about 5.7, about 5.7 degrees is the optimum angle beyond which it starts reducing in effectiveness.
Yes, 10%.
Yeah, which is 5.7 degrees. So the stock exclusion regulations have it almost exactly right in terms of a requirement to exclude up to 5 degrees.
No, because I don't think you can infer the slope of the land versus the slope of the buffer.
Right. You don't think the land will continue down to where the stream is?
Well, certainly not in all circumstances.
No.
And slopes down to streams are sometimes shallower due to whether it's a degrading stream or an upgrading stream. It's more in relation to the stream type what the slope of the buffer might be rather than the always in the circumstance of the incoming catchment slope.
Yeah, but in terms of, I think we can violently agree that there's an infinite number of stream types, micro topography on all of the farms across the Waikato catchment. There's lots of different types.
We're talking about micro topography, streams are either grading or degrading.
Right. But in terms of the hill country, there will be sloping land on either side of the stream that will slope down towards the stream.
At some slope. I'm not sure if I could agree that it was necessarily the same slope as the buffer.
Okay, but it's going to be similar, isn't it? It's not going to be significantly different.
It might be quite a lot greater, it might be quite a lot less.
Right, you just don't know. But slope does have an impact on effectiveness of buffer.
Absolutely. Incoming slope to a buffer is an important determinant of how effective that buffer will be and how fast the water will run across it and therefore entrain or infiltrate contaminants.
I'll just lastly just come back to the flexibility. So you'll be aware that my client's concerns are if there's a minimum requirement of 3 metres on farm, if they don't meet a 3 metre setback exactly, they are required to get a resource consent under some people's provisions. So let's just leave it at that for now.
Okay, I understand under some provisions.
Yeah. So do you agree that in some circumstances a degree of flexibility around that minimum setback would be appropriate from a water quality perspective?
Well, there's already a degree of flexibility around the minimum. You can be greater.
Yeah, but you can't be less, can you? So what do you do if you come across massive big rocks you can't put a fence in?
Usually you would go wider to go around them, I would presume, but I'm not a farm system.
Right. And if you needed a flat slope in order to put a fence on, you could require quite significant cuts into the back. But if you did require to do that, that would have its own water quality impacts, wouldn't it?
Temporarily, tracking does contribute.
So would you support a degree of flexibility on the ultimate location of a fence and therefore the buffer setbacks undertaken by a certified farm planner on site, walking the stream bank in order to ascertain the best location for a fence, balancing practicability, water quality benefits, topography, and all the other myriad of factors that they would need to assess? Would you support that degree of flexibility?
I've looked at the degree of flexibility that your clients are asking for, and that's on an average basis, as I understand it. I think that would be very, very difficult to assess whether you would comply with that or not.
We've got a minimum basis, yeah? There's still a minimum?
Yes.
And then it's a 3 metre average as well as that minimum?
Yes, I think that the average is quite difficult.
So you don't think you could explain in the farm environment plan how you assess that average?
I think it would be tricky and require quite a lot of measurement and potentially survey work. I don't know, it depends on the extent of the buffer and how much it varies. I think it would be difficult to assess compliance.
But possible.
Possible.
Thank you.
Just to be clear, Mr. Minhanek, you don't have any questions for this?
No questions.
And Mr. Pinnell, just to be clear, do you have any questions for this one?
No.
Thank you very much.
I'm John Forrest, I'm council for Lockheel Farmland. And before I start, I'll apologise to the court and to everyone. I'm recovering from bronchitis, so I'm doing the best with the cough, but it's not infectious, but it is annoying. So please bear with me. Ms. McCarthy, were you here yesterday for the questions that came for Mr. Trevoco from the court?
Yes, I was.
So I just wanted to start, I think it was Commissioner Hodges asked Mr. Trevoco what would be the definition that applied to a wetland, and Mr. Trevoco, or it may have been, Commissioner Mayden. The answer came that it is the RMA definition. Now, you are an ecologist. As part of your work, you would do assessments of wetlands on properties?
No, I don't.
Do you have a role in assisting councils to look at their enforcement or monitoring program?
In the broad context?
In the broad context?
Yes, because I worked for regional council and I assisted council as a consultant.
So you're aware of the NPS freshwater management requirement?
Are you speaking to wetlands?
Wetlands.
I'll have to pass that question to Dr. Robertson. I'm not a wetlands specialist.
So you're not, wetlands is not your...
No.
I'll move on to that. In relation to the ephemeral streams and so forth, you talked about the practicalities and how that might be dealt with on a farm on a day-to-day basis.
Yes, noting I'm not a farm systems expert.
Noted. But you read Mr. Robinson's evidence for Lockyer.
Yes.
And his evidence records that Lockyer has 162 kilometres of intermittent and non-intermittent streams.
Yes.
And you'd agree that on a 3,600 hectare property, identifying ephemeral streams is going to be challenging.
Well, it would just take a while after rain events. But how challenging it is depends on how long it takes you. I guess time would be a factor.
And you'd accept that the ephemeral streams are in addition to the intermittent flowing ones?
Yes, but they're on a continuum, and as I said earlier, it's very hard to determine the break point because there isn't an ecological basis for determining what is an ephemeral stream and what is an intermittent stream.
And you'd accept that's going to be even harder for a farmer to do?
Well, that's some of the reasoning behind setting the same buffer width for both of those systems.
And you'd also accept that on a property that has 162 kilometres of stream, getting out there after a rain event and working out which additional areas might need to be fenced would be challenging.
I think it would take time.
Now, you've provided rebuttal evidence regarding the Lockyer comments.
I did, strangely, haven't thought it with me.
You've never been to Lockyer, have you?
I haven't, but I visited the Aupua Tia River, not far downstream of Lockyer.
But you haven't been along any of the 7 kilometres of that stream that flows through Lockyer?
The Aupua Tia?
Yes.
I have been downstream, I understand, of a similar character when I compared it, where I have been when I compared it to the photos of Mr. Robinson.
And you'd accept that Mr. Robinson's in a pretty good position to comment on the water quality in that stream on his farm?
I didn't agree with his assessment of water quality based on nitrate concentrations that he produced in the wetlands.
My question was, you'd accept that he's in a good position to judge changes in water quality on his farm?
Well, you can't do that simply by looking at his stream.
He's in a good position to judge differences in sedimentation on that farm, isn't he?
Water clarity, yes.
And you'd agree that he's going to notice a significant infestation of koi carp?
Yes, there are certainly koi carp in the site I looked at downstream.
And you'd agree he'd also be in a position to tell you that the degree that infestation has changed over the years?
understanding of the infestation of koi carpers that has increased over time and spread upstream.
And that will of course contribute to the water clarity issues.
In terms of reef suspension, yes, but in terms of low sediment entering a catchment, no.
Do koi carp increase sediment where they're living? Apart from the actual moving around of it in the ground, how do they act? How do they operate?
They do burrow into the bank, and what's interesting to see when I did examine that particular stream is you can see the burrow holes of koi carp in the bank below the water surface, where it was clear enough to see into the water, and then above that was the significant pugging from stock, which weighed considerably more than koi carp. So, in my view, based on the research that I've read, I couldn't support the statements that Mr. Robbins had made that they were the predominant cause of the sedimentation in his stream.
His comments related to the sedimentation in the stream through Lockyer.
Yes.
You haven't been on Lockyer, have you?
I've been downstream, and the way that koi carp migrate up, I would say if there were any differences between my site visit and Lockyer, that there would have been, in fact, more koi carp in the downstream area.
You'd accept that they are, the koi carp cause a problem?
I absolutely accept that, yes.
And that they are a pest?
Absolutely.
Are they also present? No, so that's good. Well, are they present in the wetland areas managed by DOC?
I could not tell you that.
So you're... Rebuttal also is critical of the water testing that Lockyer undertakes. You'd accept there's no obligation on farmers to undertake any water quality testing at present?
Well, there's no regulation that requires them, no.
Well, there's no obligation. There's no obligation on them if they haven't got a resource consent, is there?
Well, there's no regulatory requirement or policy requirement in the NPSF, no.
You'd have been concerned if their annual testing showed an increase, though, wouldn't you?
I cannot make a comment on annual testing. It's simply anecdotal because of the nature of the stream to have different concentrations under different flow regimes. So the concentration is very dependent on flow. And I do not know the flow at the times those samples were taken, and I do not have a large enough sample size to understand that relationship and therefore draw any conclusion from it.
Thank you, Ms. McCarthy.
Your 10 metre setbacks, are they likely to be less effective if the land they flow over is channelised?
Yes, they are.
And do you know whether all or some commercial vegetable production occurs where there is channelised flow?
I don't know that because I haven't looked at all of the commercial vegetable production, but I have taken the opportunity to read the GAP vegetative buffer guidelines and look at what that says about channelised top flow, and that suggests that it requires management on a on paddock basis. So yes, it's obviously something that needs to be addressed in those systems.
And did you hear Mr. Scarsbrook give evidence last week?
Yes, I did.
And you remember that he indicated that crop rotation, at least in some circumstances, could be beneficial for preventing erosion of soil?
I can't speak to that. I don't understand the relationship between crop rotation and potential water quality benefit.
Or detriment?
Or detriment. Oh, no, not detriment either. Not to do with crop rotation, no.
Okay, well, in that case, no further questions.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Ferguson for Nadeshi said no. Thank you. Any other person present party to this proceeding seeking to cross examine? Any re-examination?
Just one point, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. MacArthur, my friend Mr. Conway asked you a question around the stop exclusions in terms of making sure when expressed in the plan they're clear enough for farmers to follow, that it's important to have clear expression of those stop exclusions. And do you also consider having reference to the target attribute states that are relevant, referenced in those somewhere in the provisions as well?
In the Schedule C provisions?
Or in the plan?
In the plan,
yes.
I would leave that to Ms. Kissick in terms of where it would best fit in the plan provisions. But I, my answer earlier was that it should be known in terms of the contextual information, and there's a need to communicate that clearly.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Rhonda.
Briefly, Ms. McCarthy, you'll be pleased to know. Good afternoon. I've just got four points of clarification, please. You're aware that I was interested in the time required for any detectable improvement in the environment.
Yes.
And what I'm thinking about here is purely the time after which management plans become effective, you would expect to see some kind of improvement in the river. And the reason for saying that is that it's going to take possibly 5 years before the effectiveness of the measures even start, and then that only leaves 5 years before for improvements to be detected. Could you comment on that, please?
I think I'd refer back to the joint witness statement, and I can't put my finger on the exact question right now, but our expectation was that the E. coli reductions might occur quite quickly as a result of, well, particularly under low flow, as a result of getting stock out of streams and avoiding direct deposition. The wider catchment scale E. coli that comes in with rainfall is more problematic, and that might take quite a considerable amount of time to shift, if we can shift it significantly at all. It's a real difficulty. Nitrogen and phosphorus may take longer, as well as sediment, because there are issues that PC1 does not address with respect to sediment transport into water, such as hillslope erosion and forestry. So that would be a really difficult one for me to give you a solid answer on how long we might expect that to take. It may require other things to happen.
I think you might be able to tell me within the next month.
Sorry,
No, okay, look, that's fine. But realistically, a 5-year period may not achieve very significant reductions for the reasons you Would that be a fair comment or not?
Yes, other than reducing that E. coli at low flows and the on flow of that towards cultural recreational values to improve community health. Yes.
Thank you. And obviously an important issue for you and for everyone else really is that the monitoring undertaken from here on in is appropriate. Do you have any comment on do you have any concerns that there are some issues that are not proposed to be monitored adequately?
I've largely worked with Mr. Kissick in terms of the methods that we're looking to monitoring for the next plan,
yes.
And had input to the things, the parameters that she suggests there. There's a bit of a difficulty with the estuary as well and the lack of monitoring there that we've identified in the joint witness statement that hasn't been addressed or has been done. And dissolved oxygen, as I understand it from Dr. Scarsbrook, is in its infancy in terms of monitoring and needs to probably ramp up quite significantly this summer. I think that's the majority of my concerns with respect to monitoring.
Thank you. And you may not be able to answer this question, but I know you're very familiar with the issue of ecosystem health and toxicity and the fact that when you're looking at ecosystem health, you can quite often require much lower concentrations in the river.
Yes.
Have you done any work on that in the PC1 area?
I believe I did at the council level hearing. I think cast my mind back. We did a conference on what that should look like. I had a wider brief on the council level hearing in terms of bringing in aspects of ecosystem health and what attributes might contribute towards improving that, which this is a more narrow brief that we have here. And that was looking at levels of nitrogen and phosphorus that are related to periphyton growth and Dr. Cannon's work around macro vertebrate health and the relationship of that with dissolved nutrients. So there were some suggestions made in the JWS, which I think I attached to my evidence, but I can't recall the exact numbers off the top of my head.
Okay, I guess where I'm coming from, I'm interested in the long term and the sort of overall requirements to get down to the required attribute today.
Yes.
And I can't remember the exact figures either, but there's something, so many thousand tons of nitrogen that have to be removed to get down to toxicity.
Yes.
I'm just trying to get some idea, is that going to be 8,000 or 10,000 tons once you get ecosystem health? Do you have any thoughts on that? Or just
My understanding from Dr. Osei's table 2, where he summarised how much of the load needs to go for nitrogen and phosphorus. My understanding of that was for that to reach the TN, total nitrogen and total phosphorus attribute states, long-term attribute states in the main stem of the river. I did understand from council that they weren't going to be reviewed in the main stem, and that was needing to look back up catchment and see what's required to get there. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Can I just clarify, if they're going to be looking at ecosystem health in PC1 in the 2024 plan change,
yes.
Which I imagine they would have to,
yes.
Surely that might change the attribute, the target attribute states for nitrogen. Would that be the case?
Oh, it would really change them in the sub-catchments because of that requirement in section 313 of the MPS to look at downstream sensitive receiving environments and to back populate that essentially up into the rest of the catchment to meet what the needs of those downstream sensitive receiving environments are. And then the other prong of that, if you like, is to manage the dissolved nutrients in the reach that is receiving those concentrations for ecosystem health. So in order to achieve section 3.13 in its totality, you have to do both of those things. And I understand that the council is embarking on that process.
Okay, thank you. And just one thing, I'd be interested in your thoughts on changing weather patterns over a September. And I'm going back here to team work for a couple of schools.
Yes.
And the situation there was very different in that the annual rainfall was up to 4,000 millimetres in some areas. But do you consider that changing rainfall patterns could affect your ability to meet the target requirements?
We know, actually, from some very early work that Dr. Scarsbrook did, I believe in 2003, that climate has a significant influence on nitrogen concentrations in particular. The degree to which we understand that relationship further across all contaminants is not well understood, and I think that the study that we referenced in the joint witness statement, I think it was Wood et al. With respect to E. coli and climate, didn't show a relationship between those two things. So we're still a little bit in the dark, I think. We know that in a rainy year, more contaminants are pushed through, and in a drier year, less contamination occurs, and you could make some predictions based on El Nino or La Nina cycles, but wider climate patterns and climate change is much more difficult, I think, to provide us for because we don't have a good understanding of the relationship, particularly in this catchment, between concentration, load, and climate. So not very helpful.
You're basically saying that it's something you need to consider.
Oh, absolutely, but I don't think we currently have the mechanisms to be able to do that justice.
Yeah, I do understand that too. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Just following on from the Commissioner's question, I mean, your answer properly acknowledges some scientific uncertainty about relationships, causal relationships, or cause and effect. And there are aspects of that that are also being raised here in terms of the mechanisms, particularly the rule mechanisms in Plan Change 1 for trying to effect changes in anthropogenic effects.
Yes.
I suppose the question is that it seems to me that whichever side you look at it from, there may be uncertainty about certain aspects of certain things, but there's no doubt about the fundamentals, which is that more intensive farming leads to more contaminants of these four kinds in waterways.
That's what the research tells us.
Exactly. And do you agree that that really should be the main driver in PC1, with your work and the work of many other scientists going on to continue to investigate the boundary issues, the issues that are in the shadows of the big issues, to get a better understanding of the detail of the cause and effect?
I think it's a yes but, sir.
Yeah, well, that's fine.
Yes but the recent or more recent intensification that we've had poses quite a significant problem in terms of how far we need to go.
Well, that's been the temporal timing aspect of the whole thing. And I, from my reading of the statements and the joint witness statements of the scientists, it doesn't appear that anybody is saying, oh, we don't have to do anything for a while.
No, I would say there's quite an urgency.
Exactly.
Getting to 80 years, we don't currently know. I don't think how we can get there.
No, indeed. Well, it was a concern that Commissioner Hodges and I expressed at early conferences that the 80-year horizon should not be treated as an opportunity to kick back and say, well, I'm unlikely to be around at that stage, so what do I care? It's actually a real question of the enormity of the task, and that's why there's a 20% target in the first 10 years to try and indicate, to some extent, that urgency. But the point of all of this, it seems to me, is that some of the disagreements about the various analyses, including the statistical analyses, the first order of our effort should really be on making sure that everybody who is involved in land use in these catchments appreciates the scale of the problem and the fact that time is not actually on our side. Would you agree with that?
I thoroughly agree, and I think that's what the MPS, the Freshwater, anticipates, is that freshwater management is everybody's business.
And to that extent, would it be fair then to say that the implementation of the rules in Plan Change 1, and this may be a question you may want to leave to Ms. Pizzer, that the implementation of the rules has a degree of priority ahead of some of the other methods that are set out in the Plan Change?
I probably couldn't speak to the planning provisions, but I was concerned to listen to Mr. Trevilco's evidence on how long those consent timeframes might be when he's speaking of 20, late 30s, 40s, and that really still pushes our timeframe in terms of the 80-year target.
Planning on calling Dr. Rock next?
Yes, sir.
Very good. All right. So, if